Senator Lundy is loved. Senator Conroy's isn't loved. Prime Minister Gillard has to pick a new cabinet, if only to fill the ministerial vacancies created because she's moved up to the top job. What are Lundy's chances? Well, over at independent news site Crikey, where I'm also a contributor, my esteemed colleague Bernard Keane is Canberra correspondent. Bernard, it has to be said that the geeks really don't like Senator Conroy. Most of that angst is about the government's plan for internet censorship. But as communications ministers go, I mean, is he really that bad?
As communications ministers go, he's actually, I've got to confess, I mean, I'm no fan of Conroy either, but he has achieved a lot more than I think several of his predecessors put together. I mean, on telecommunications, he has landed some pretty significant reforms. I mean, we're talking the sort of reforms that we should have had 20 years ago, and he's presided over the commencement of the NBN. So on those grounds alone, Conroy, I think, has racked up a pretty considerable achievement. I mean, comms is always a difficult portfolio because
it's almost a poison chalice, isn't it? Because you can't please anyone.
Well, you've got the twin problems, of course, that they're such high-profile issues that the Prime Minister's office tends to run things anyway. But you invariably end up with the most difficult reform issues in your portfolio. But most portfolios are lucky to have one really juicy reform issue. Comms usually has two or more. That means that the ministers are constantly in the firing line. There's heavy interference in the portfolio. It's difficult to actually deploy resources effectively to really address issues. But Conroy has certainly undoubtedly been concentrating pretty much full time on telecommunications, with occasional diversions into censoring the internet. But he's managed to rack up substantial reforms. I mean, the structural separation issue, I mean, it may be obvious to blind Freddy that this is a sort of basic reform that Australia has needed for a couple of decades, but Conroy's not merely pursued it, he's on the verge of bringing it about. I mean, we know that there are serious negotiations to be pursued between NBN Co and Telstra, so it's by no means a done deal, but by God, we're much, much closer than we were under Richard Alston or Darrell Williams or Helen Coonan to a somewhat faintly pro-competitive telecommunications regulation framework.
And I was about to say, I mean, it really is Conroy who forced Telstra to play ball. I mean, the whole NBN program as it is, wasn't it Senator Conroy talking Prime Minister Rudd into this, into committing what could have been $43 billion on the basis of it, like a conversation in the back of the prime ministerial jet?
I mean, and this is why Rudd noticeably thanked him last Sunday in the announcement about the deal with Telstra. Conroy's played hardball, but he's also negotiated effectively. And this is one of the hallmarks of the Rudd government was actually an inability to actually negotiate effectively with key stakeholders and crossbench senators. Julia Gillard could do it. Nicola Roxon could do it. And in another context outside the political arena, Conroy was able to do it as well. Undoubtedly, the fact that the KPMG McKinsey report sort of very bluntly said this can be done without Telstra would have added to the pressure. But at the end of the day, Conroy's managed to land a deal. So on telecommunications, you've got to give Conroy a pretty solid tick for his 3 years of effort.
We did mention Senator Richard Alston before when he was communications minister. Both you and I are old enough to remember that. For the young'uns, and perhaps for my fading memory, why do we hate him again?
This is the minister who first earned the title of global village idiot for his efforts to censor and regulate the internet. This was back in a period when there was no online regulatory regime whatsoever.
That's true. There was nothing, was there?
Absolutely nothing. So it was regulated to the extent that it was regulated at all under telecommunications regulations. There was a whole process of regulation of re-regulation of both telecommunications and of broadcasting under Richard Alston, who took the portfolio in 1996 and it was around until, I think, I don't know, 2001, 2002. Alston oversaw an attempt to actually heavily restrict what could be distributed online that might end up rivaling the TV networks. So there was a quite sort of unsubtle attempt to actually regulate any sort of IPTV with a sort of a preemptive regulatory strike that would have basically banned it.
that was also Alston's kind of regime when the internet became television, because the internet is on a computer screen, it's a screen, and therefore it's a kind of movie.
The key to all this was that Alston didn't really understand the state of online media at that point, let alone its potential. And he was hostage to this process of very technically specific, very technology specific regulatory approaches. I mean, Australia's whole media regulatory framework for generations has been technology specific. I mean, that's the whole point of cross media regulations. It says, well, you've got three types of media, and they're all very important. So we're going to make sure that they're not controlled in a way that could be threatening. So that whole approach of let's have media specific regulation was obviously in the blood of not merely Richard Alston, but I think pretty much every politician back then. So yes, he twice earned the title of Global Village Idiot for his complete cluelessness about online. I've never seen this actually confirmed, but there's a famous claim that he thought broadband was only good for porn and gambling, a claim I've got to say that has not entirely been disproven all these years. but that kind of summed up his approach to broadband. It was like, well, what do you need broadband for if you're a clean living individual? You don't need that sort of thing. That's that kind of summed up his approach to online. I mean, in other ways, Alston wasn't such a bad minister. I mean, the real villain of the piece throughout the Howard government was first John Fay and then Nick Minchin, because they're the ones who oversaw the privatisation of Telstra as an integrated entity. And that's what left our telco sector struggling for years and years to be competitive. So this reflects a basic reality of the communications portfolio, which is that for all the communications minister might actually even want to do some good, and I put Helen Coonan in that category, they end up being stymied because the Prime Minister and senior economics ministers end up intervening.
This is the thing, because whenever any of the no clean feed obsessives see Conroy in the media, they jump on him, they flood all of the forums, but I don't think they get that a minister is just someone doing a job implementing a policy, and the policy is developed certainly during the Rudd government from a higher level.
That's right. I mean, Kevin Rudd himself was a key proponent of a mandatory filter. The best hope of achieving a change really lies in the fact that as a new Prime Minister, Julia Gillard has a clean slate. There can be a strong case argued that this is an unpopular policy, certainly a strong case that it's an ineffective policy, and it could profitably be abandoned, I think, by the new room. Or certainly, I mean, this is not legislation that is going to make it through Parliament, and I suspect not even going to be introduced into Parliament before the election. So even assuming that there's a late election and there's another sitting of Parliament, so it then becomes an issue that will be addressed in the election policy context. And I think the efforts of opponents should really be targeted at ensuring that Julia Gillard does not include this policy in those that she takes to the election, or that the policy she includes has an opt-out, or you know, something along the lines that Kate Lundy has suggested, which would be consistent with the 07 policy and make much more electoral sense than a policy that's that antagonises a small but vocal minority, of whom, of course, I'm a member myself.
Well, this is the thing. How big a deal is internet filtering to the government, to the electorate, to the voters? I mean, as I've said, you and me and the enthusiasts pounce on this, but really, does anyone actually care in Canberra?
It's certainly not a vote changer issue. It's certainly not even close to being a vote changing issue for most people. It is part of Kevin Rudd's attempt to paint himself as a Mr. Mainstream, as being a bloke who is thoroughly in touch with the values of most Australians. Beyond that, I don't think it actually has much utility to the government. But equally, it's not the sort of issue that they would be particularly concerned about in terms of electoral impact. So it's a sort of issue which is sufficiently, I guess, below the political radar that it could actually be argued on its merits. I mean, we're dealing with a rule of thumb here that says that there's policy and there's politics when it comes to individual government decisions. This might be one which could be effectively dealt with purely on policy grounds, because once you get away from this idea that you somehow want to convince Australians that you share their values by telling them that you want to censor their internet. In fact, you can tell Australians that you share their values through, I think, other much more effective ways. Then I think that's a or should be a compelling argument to put to politicians. Now, whether they pursue it or not, obviously remains to be seen, but it's not, I suspect, going to be helped by people urging a change of ministerial lineup. I don't think Kate Lundy is going to be any more inclined to resist the will of the overall government in its policy decisions than Stephen Conroy is.
Well, I'll come to that in a minute, but at the end of 2008, you wrote that Conroy was one of the three weakest links in Kevin Rudd's government at that time. Do you still stand by that, or do you think it's changed?
I think now that he's landed the NBN, that's got to be revised. I mean, Conroy achieved nothing for an extended period, but has managed to end up landing two of the biggest reforms that this government is going to pursue. So that's in telecommunications. I mean, in broadcasting, he's been up sort of every bit as bad as his predecessors, and he's perpetuating a highly damaging anti-competitive framework there. But he's emerged from the whole NBN saga with his credibility intact and his and perhaps enhanced. I mean, if Telstra had not come to the party before the election, though, I think we'd be talking about very different terms. We'd be talking about the appearance of a government that was simply unable to deal with industry, unable to get its reforms through, unable to do what it set out to do. So there was genuine appreciation from Rudd when he thanked Conroy last Sunday, because if he hadn't landed Telstra, then it would have played to all the criticisms that have been made of this government about being all talk and not actually getting anything done.
So what are the chances then of Conroy being replaced by Lundy? I mean, the kids are all out there going, you know, we've got a left-wing prime minister, Kate Lundy's on the left wing, Conroy's on the right wing, and he's the village idiot, although, as we've just discussed, maybe not so much.
Yeah, I think zero to none, more or less. I mean, we can always be surprised, but why would Conroy be moved on? Well, either he'd be, in effect, sacked, or he'd be promoted, or he'd be moved to another portfolio because he wanted to be. As we've been talking about, I mean, the grounds for him losing the job, if he wants to keep it, are probably pretty slim, particularly given that he's a power broker in the Victorian right.
Well, indeed.
And it's probably not completely irrelevant that there is currently in place in Victorian Labor a deal between the right, including Bill Shorten and Stephen Conroy, and elements of the left. A deal that's been ticked off by Julia Gillard herself. So I'm not sure she's about to go off and do anything that might upset one of the key power brokers in the Victorian ALP.
That would almost be suicidal, one would think. But Nick Bruffell, who we've heard from just before, has suggested that one way Prime Minister Gillard could handle this is to essentially kick Conroy upstairs to replace Lindsay Tanner as Minister for Finance and Deregulation. Could that work? I mean, move Conroy from a portfolio where he's unpopular against this, as you say, small but very vocal segment, but still give him essentially a promotion.
The promotion to those sorts of positions, you know...
I mean, finance, I understand, is a big promotion.
Well, it's not necessarily a big promotion, but it's a key economic portfolio, and... the personnel who are candidates for that have got to be people who are going to be a safe pair of hands in the most critical portfolios of the government. So whether Conroy fits that bill, I'm not sure. Maybe he does, maybe he doesn't. I mean, there's no spectacular candidate, standout candidate to replace Lindsay Tanner. I mean, if we just look at the maths of this, I mean, Gillard has said she doesn't want to have a big reshuffle, so that probably mitigates against any sort of movement of someone like Conroy who doesn't need to be moved. Bill Shorten has got to come into the ministry, if not into cabinet. I don't think he'll get into cabinet, but he'll certainly come into the ministry. Rudd might decide to swallow his pride and serve Gillard in that capacity, in her cabinet, so that might reduce the numbers further. So once you look at where the spots are going to, the vacancies are going to be, it's very hard to see why Conroy would move unless he wanted to. Look, if he wanted to, all bets are off. He could move on. Then you get to the next question of would Kate Lundy be promoted up to replace him? And that I think is even less likely.
Really? Because, I mean, she's got experience. She was shadow minister for communications under Kim Beazley.
She's
well respected.
She's certainly well respected and knows the portfolio. That traditionally has had very little to do with the selection of who actually gets to be a communications minister. The problem is, as I said right at the start, is that you need someone that is actually going to be able to work through the deals. Is it going to be able to keep very high-profile stakeholders happy, or as happy as you can possibly make them? I mean, you're dealing with the Rupert Murdochs of the world, the Kerry Stokes, the people who can kill you in the media. So, I mean, probably the first requirement for an effective communications minister is someone who can actually keep those sorts of people on side whilst trying to actually achieve half-decent policy. I mean, there are a couple of other reasons that might bear mentioning in terms of Kate Lundy. I mean, she's from the ACT. She's therefore not got a strong sort of – there's no geographic reason why she might be in line for a promotion. She's on the left, but, I mean, really the ascension of Gillard, who is, of course, as we know, on the left herself, has really been primarily engineered by the right. There's no need to repay favours. And one other thing, Lundy is married to a long-time Optus spinner and former union official. So I don't know how many tragics out there would have routinely watched or read the transcripts of Senate estimates, but for many years, Kate Lundy would ask an extensive array of questions on telecommunications issues of ministers for communication. She'd invariably preface those by saying, you know, full disclosure, I'm married to an Optus executive. It's not a killer issue, but it's one more complication, I think, in the reason why I don't think she'd be a candidate. I think probably overall, the other key reason is that there is so much strong talent in the junior ranks of the House of Representatives section of the Labor Party that I think they're likely to be tapped before they go to Kate Lundy. I'm talking about I've mentioned Bill Shorten before, but Maxine McHugh, Mike Kelly, perhaps even Mark Butler from South Australia. They're all very, very talented individuals. I suspect they'll get into the ministry well ahead of Kate Lundy.
Now, I should mention that both you and I have been, of course, personally attacked by Senator Conroy late last year. We've been called liars, deliberate distorters of the truth. Electronic Frontiers Australia has been similarly attacked. Is that unusual, or is this really just this is just par for the course, isn't it?
Well, I mean, to an extent, I mean, I'm quite happy to be attacked by Stephen Conroy. I mean, at the least, he reflected a willingness to get down and actually get to grips with his critics. In a way that I see very few ministers doing. So I was actually quite pleased that he was prepared to engage on those terms. I don't, a bit of verbal biffo is not a
That's Australia's robust standard of political debate.
Well, exactly, it's all good clean fun. So good on him. I thought it's I'd rather have that than a minister who just completely ignores his critics and won't engage with them. It shows a certain intellectual credibility on Conroy's part that he was prepared to mix it up. I mean, I disagree with his arguments, as you would have, but, you know, at least he was trying to justify his case. And look, you know, look, 10 years down the track when Conroy's left, or 20 years when Conroy's left politics and he's written his memoirs, for all we know, he'll reveal that that he absolutely hated the filter and it infuriated him every time he had to defend it. But he's doing a job as a professional politician to implement government policy, and it's the same job that Kate Lundy would do if she became a communications minister. You implement government policy, you don't get a choice about these things. There is such a thing as cabinet solidarity, which means that that you do what you're told. So that's probably the, you know, if there's a real politic angle on all this, it's that, you know, much the same way that Peter Garrett got bagged for letting a uranium mine through. Well, as a minister, you have certain responsibilities, and implementing government policy is actually one of those responsibilities. And you know, if you don't do it, you're not a minister.
Well, indeed, and that comes finally to the mechanics of this. Do we know yet when would the new cabinet be announced?
Look, I don't think it'll be far away. In fact, I had a brief moment when I thought today that Julie Gillard might surprise us by rushing it out. She's got to work out what Kevin Rudd is going to do. She's got to work out whether she keeps Lindsay Tanner until the election. I suspect she won't on that particular score. She's got to find a slot for Bill Shorten. I suspect Tony Burke will be moved somewhere more high profile than his agriculture. She's got agriculture and population at the moment.
Yeah, maybe. They're riveting, aren't they?
Well, I mean, population looked for a while like being a hot-button issue, but it seems to have gone quiet. So maybe Bill Shorten can move to agriculture and Burke could ascend to higher stations. Chris Bowen, who has been, for mine, the most impressive minister in the government so far, may yet be promoted as well. But he's doing a lot of good work in his current portfolio. He's already been moved once. So, you know, but it's quite possible he might be considered for finance minister. I think this will all happen over the weekend. And we'll see a minimalist reshuffle early next week, just so there's you know, a minimum of disruption and delay in the public service. Obviously, Gillard herself's got to find a replacement for herself in her mega portfolio. It might end up being split, but remember, back before the last election, Stephen Smith was the education spokesperson, and actually expected to get the job after the election. So if Kevin Rudd actually agrees to stick around, that might actually solve a particular problem that Gillard's got of trying to replace herself, because obviously that might free up Stephen Smith to swing over to his previous portfolio. But we don't know. These things are always can always surprise us. Picking these reshuffles is a lot harder even than picking leadership spills. So,
and I was tempted to say 24 hours before it happened, you said it wasn't going to happen. So there you go. Great, isn't it?
I will defend myself on the basis that I believe, and in fact, you'll see a lot of commentary to this effect today, that there was going to be no spill until that story about Kevin Rudd and his disastrous miscalculation about sending Alastair Jordan out to canvass the numbers broke. After that point, that's when it all happened. And what happened after that didn't have too much to do with what happened before that, except for the fact that Kevin Rudd had steadily dug himself into a hole that he appeared to have not merely no way of getting out of, but no intention of actually stopping digging.
Bernard Keane, thank you very much for your time today.
Good to talk to you.